Hello, it's Monday, November the 3rd, 2008. I'm Mike Duran. On today's podcast, the West warns of humanitarian crisis in the Democratic Republic of Congo.
They haven't even actually been able to assess how many people have been forced from their homes. There's an estimated figure of around 250,000 since August.
With just hours till the US polls open, will America get its first black president?
Early voting appears to favor Obama. There's been heavy turnout by Democrats in crucial states like Colorado. What happens now, what's crucial now, is whether Obama can get his supporters to the polls tomorrow on polling day.
Plus Simon Sharma on the Bush legacy.
So I actually don't think history's going to be a lot more charitable than I am currently being to this particular period of government.
The men at the helm of the banking crisis get a grilling. And Lewis Hamilton, the youngest ever Formula One world champion. First, the news headlines and a paper digest with Sandy Waugh.
Britain has a new world champion. Lewis Hamilton became the world champion racing driver after the Brazilian Grand Prix. He beat Felipe Massa by only 1 point on the season's results. Massa won yesterday's race on his home territory, and Hamilton just got the crucial position of fifth in the last lap. The last British champion was Damon Hill back in 1996. Hamilton is the youngest ever Formula One champion at 23 and has only been racing in F1 for 2 years. We'll have more on this story later in Guardian Daily. In Congo, the UN is to send its first aid in a week into rebel-held areas. It's believed that up to 250,000 people have had to leave their homes during the fighting in the north of the country. The British and French foreign ministers have been in the area and have told Congo and neighbouring Rwanda that they are responsible for controlling the violence. Today, they'll report back to a meeting of European ministers in Marseille. A 35-year-old man from Hackney has died in hospital from anthrax. Drum maker Fernando Gomez worked all the time with imported animal skins out of which he made his drums. He's thought to have inhaled anthrax spores from the skins. His flat and workshop have been sealed off by health authorities, and they've warned others making drums of the dangers, but they say that drum players are unlikely to be affected. The faces of young people willing to take a stand against knife crime will appear on posters across England and Wales. The posters will be put up in areas prone to knife crime. Young people who want to back the campaign can sign up on Bebo by going to the page titled, "It Doesn't Have to Happen." With only hours left of campaigning in the American election, pollsters reckon that Barack Obama's lead is increasing to between 8 and 10%. In Ohio, he drew a crowd of 80,000 in Cleveland with the help of singer Bruce Springsteen. Meanwhile, John McCain was in Pennsylvania and told supporters the race was in fact tightening and the Republicans would win. We'll hear more shortly. Lewis Hamilton claims all the front and back pages of the papers with his Formula One win. There are pictures of him with his girlfriend, his father, and draped in the Union Jack. Last lap Lewis, the Mail calls him. Last gasp Hamilton, says the Times. And the Guardian sums up the race this way: final flourish. Hamilton races to the world title after last bend drama. Writer Richard Williams says that with 250,000 to go, Hamilton was set to fail for the second year running. The BBC lewd phone calls row has another line. David Cameron tells The Sun he would slash the salaries of BBC top brass. The Guardian reports that those same bosses will instead re-examine the salaries of top presenters. More seriously, The Times and The Financial Times return to the economy and the meetings of monetary policymakers in Britain and Europe. Both papers say pressure is mounting for rate cuts. Economists expect at least 0.5% cut. Many think that may be too little, too late. More on the day's news and breaking stories at guardian.co.uk.
First today, we look at the crisis in the Democratic Republic of Congo. European diplomats warn that 1.6 million people are facing a humanitarian emergency. The British and French foreign ministers have been in Rwanda calling for urgent action. David Miliband and Bernard Kouchner have promised aid, but both have stopped short of saying they'll send in EU troops to protect civilians. Thousands of displaced who fled fighting in the east are returning to their villages because they didn't receive any aid. The Guardian's Africa correspondent Chris McGreal says the situation is desperate.
The aid agencies haven't been able to get to most of the people yet, and they haven't even actually been able to assess how many people have been forced from their homes. There's an estimated figure of around 250,000 since August, but nobody really knows. Many have fled into the forest, some have fled across borders. Some are simply in refugee camps that were old refugee camps that have kind of got new life from this movement of people. There are reports that the rebels themselves, the Tutsi-led rebels, are forcing people out the camp, saying it's safe to go home and they should return. It seems that this is possibly a move by them to preempt any kind of embarrassing pictures of large numbers of refugees needing help from aid agencies. But the aid workers and the United Nations are trying to put together a convoy to move up the road out of Goma towards these refugees sometime during Monday.
Now, the headlines to this story focus on a crisis in Congo, but the Foreign Secretary David Miliband has flown to Rwanda, hasn't he? What's its role in this conflict?
Well, the roots of this whole conflict go back to the 1994 genocide in Rwanda. At that point, a million Hutus fled across the border into what was then Zaire and later became Congo. Amongst those Hutus were the militia that had carried out the genocide, the army that had also been involved in the genocide, and some of the political leaders. And they used the UN-run camps as kind of basis to continue the war against the new Tutsi government in Rwanda. That in itself, 2 years later, prompted an invasion by the Rwandan government, the Rwandan army, to clear those camps. And really, that conflict continues today in one form or another. Now, a crucial part of that is the rebel Tutsi general, Laurent Nkunda. Now, Nkunda had been part of the Tutsi rebel army that had won in Rwanda against the Hutu extremists, and he then went over into Congo and join the conflict there. And Rwanda is perceived, because of its links with Nkunda, which go back quite some way, to have influence over him. Some people say they support him. Rwanda denies this, but there's absolutely no doubt that he retains ties to the military and the security establishment inside Rwanda.
He has been indicted as a war criminal, this is Nkunda. Has that affected his power at all?
It's been embarrassing for Rwanda, which is why that they've put some distance between them and him. At the same time, there is still a very large contingent of Hutu extremists in eastern Congo that control about 40% of the territory of North and South Kivu along the border there. And Rwanda sees him, Nkunda, as something of a buffer between them and these Hutu extremists. It's also true that all of these rebel groups, not just Nkunda's, have been involved in war crimes. Mass rape has become really a tactic of conflict in eastern Congo. Probably hundreds of thousands of women have been raped, stealing food from civilians, killing civilians, recruiting child soldiers. It's practiced by all of these groups, and including the Congolese army at times. So Nkunda's indictment is an embarrassment from Rwanda, but at the same time, it doesn't single him out as uniquely evil in this conflict.
Finally, Chris, Britain supplies nearly half of the total international aid to Rwanda. Does that give David Miliband any political leverage to put pressure on the country?
I think it does. I mean, Rwanda has become increasingly allied with Britain as time has gone by, partly because of this aid we're talking about, also because Britain is really offered it a lot of political and diplomatic support internationally, so much so that Rwanda is now applying to join the British Commonwealth, even though it was never a British colony. Recently, Rwanda has announced that it will switch its entire education system from French to English, and so it's very much aligning itself internationally in the Anglo camp with the Americans, but particularly I think with the British. So that does give Britain some leverage over Kagame. It's also true that Kagame is very close to the former British Prime Minister Tony Blair, who is expected to visit Kigali in about a week's time. And I think as Rwanda looks more to English-speaking East Africa and to Britain and America, and places itself firmly in that camp, I think that does give Britain a certain amount of diplomatic leverage, yes.
Chris McGreal. Elsewhere on The Guardian's website, the BBC says it'll pay its top stars less. See what less means at guardian.co.uk/media. Could grime, it's a type of urban music, two-step breakbeats and around 140 beats per minute, that kind of thing. So could grime be the new frontier in the fight against youth crime? guardian.co.uk/music. Have a peek into the world of Roman Abramovich as his empire is revealed in the courts. guardian.co.uk/Russia. and Spike Milligan's notes and other memorabilia up for auction. Details at guardian.co.uk/culture. Next, to America, where it's less than 24 hours till Election Day. Barring recounts, we should know who'll be the 44th President of the United States by midweek. Ralph Nader on the left and Bob Barr on the right are unlikely to take the title, with Barack Obama heading most polls by nearly 10 points. John McCain's campaign team, meanwhile, is saying publicly it still believes its man will win. The Guardian's Suzanne Goldenberg says the candidates will be promulgating their final message right up to the wire.
We are now in the last 48 hours of a presidential campaign that has been nearly 2 years in the making. And the two candidates, Barack Obama and John McCain, have very different messages for their closing arguments. Basically, Barack Obama has returned to his message of hope and change. He's going out and telling supporters, we've got the righteous wind at our back. It's almost as if the Democrats feel that they are indeed on the cusp of victory. From the McCain campaign, we're getting a very different message. Really, they're trying to rally their supporters and to convince them that McCain can bring this home. He's down in the polls, but they insist that he is a man who's come back before and that he could make a surprising comeback again.
And has any of the adverse press against Sarah Palin over the weekend, has that impacted on the McCain campaign?
Well, the McCain campaign now has two jokey stories on its plate. One is a bit of humor that the McCain campaign organized itself. That was John McCain's appearance on Saturday Night Live, which went down very well. He showed himself as a good sport. Unfortunately for the campaign, Sarah Palin herself became the butt of a joke when she was punked by some comedians from Montreal. She picked up the phone thinking she was talking to Mr. Sarkozy, the French leader. Instead, it was a couple of comedians, and she made a couple of jokes about going hunting with them.
And what about McCain and Obama? Will they be working the crowds tomorrow, or will they be accepting their fate?
Both candidates have a furious schedule until Tuesday morning, and indeed they may campaign on Tuesday. We are seeing Obama going into Republican terrain today. He campaigns in North Carolina and Florida, and he's got a huge rally scheduled in the Virginia suburbs of Washington, D.C. On today, the final full day of campaigning, we're seeing John McCain and Sarah Palin together making 14 stops. That's 8 stops for McCain. And he is going to have to actually shore up his defenses in Republican states. He's not making as many forays into enemy territory as Obama, not by any means. He's trying to hold his ground.
Suzanne, you're the expert. Who's going to win?
All the indicators point to a good night for Barack Obama on Tuesday. He's ahead in the polls. He's ahead in finances. He's ahead in organization. And it appears he's ahead in terms of votes in the bank. Early voting appears to favor Obama. There's been heavy turnout by Democrats in crucial states like Colorado. What happens now, what's crucial now, is whether Obama can get his supporters to the polls tomorrow on polling day.
Now, having looked ahead to tomorrow's voting, we ask, what is the Bush legacy? Historian and broadcaster Simon Sharma has written in today's Guardian about the 43rd President of the United States. For Guardian Daily, he broke down the positives and negatives, as he sees it, of George Walker Bush's time in the Oval Office.
The essential thing about this administration is it draws to a close a period of American history that began with Ronald Reagan's ascent to office, in which hardcore conservative principles that have been raised in the first place by Barry Goldwater and then by philosophers like Russell Kirk would actually be put to the test of government, in particular whether or not you could grow the economy even though you cut taxes, or whether you had to cut taxes in order to grow the economy, whether you could shrink the government, and thirdly, very importantly, whether or not America had some sort of superior mission in the world to spread democracy, both for her own security and also for the general happiness and good of the rest of the world. All those issues were variously put to the test in the years that followed. They were interrupted by the Clinton years. They were interrupted by occasionally insecure control of Congress. But it was in the first 6 years, because in 2006, the Bush administration lost control of Congress. But in those first 6 years, ultimately, that conservatism was put to the test. And those who are not sympathetic to it will say, as Barack Obama has been saying, this is where it's got us.
Do you believe that this conservative ideology has been successful on any level?
No, is the short answer to that. I suppose unless, you know, as a conservative, you're really committed to the notion of shrinking government, so that you would want, for example, to roll back environmental protection and make sure the business in its own self-interest would take care of that. But the bitter irony, I suppose, for the conservatives is that they've been forced to do, by historical circumstance, things which go against their nature and against the grain. It's under, just recently, admittedly, in a very extreme situation, it's under Bush that the banks have been nationalized, and this gigantic, gigantic shift from private to the public sector in finance has taken place. Time and time again, the Bush government has been forced to do things which involve it in government rather than make it contract the government, whether or not discovering that you really did need to build, to nation build in Iraq, or whether you really did need to make sure there was an effective government in place after a catastrophe like Hurricane Katrina. So what's extraordinarily weird about this campaign is to see the nostrums of this failed conservatism being given second life in the rhetoric of the Republican campaign, even as they've crumbled for the moment without much hope of being repaired in political reality.
Your piece in today's Guardian is a first writing of history. Given time, could we look upon the Bush administration more positively?
Probably not. I think certainly what I think the figure of the president himself might be modified. The real issue, I think, as historians come to look at it, is how much he was calling the shots. He'd like to call himself the decider. There's a current view that the deciding was very much done by Dick Cheney, and in the earlier period of the administration, people like Donald Rumsfeld and John Ashcroft. That's probably a little unfair to George Bush. I think he did make decisions, so for good or ill. Certainly the sense in which he has never been a racist, that certainly can be said of him, that his immigration policy was genuinely meant to find a way for illegal immigrants to become, in the fullness of time, citizens, not even the fullness of time, a proper path to citizenship. He's been exemplary and much more adventurous than democratic administrations in delivering colossal aid to the AIDS-stricken countries of Africa. There are certainly good things to say about him and some of the initiatives. It also might be possible in the fullness of time to say that no one could quite have predicted the sort of meltdown that's most recently happened, although there have been figures who've been predicted exactly such a thing. When the last barriers were removed, not on Bush's watch, but in 1999, in the waning days of the Clinton administration, the last barriers got removed from the kind of business that commercial banks could do in the securities trade, which has led to the hell of derivative meltdown and disaster. So I think maybe one couldn't predict a perfect storm, but no president really ought to go into office on a kind of sunny Jim Pollyanna basis, assuming that all was going to be for the best of the best possible worlds, even if it was extraordinary to have been hit with 9/11. Time and time again, George Bush has said we couldn't have known this. He said it about 9/11, when the fact was that there were all sorts of intelligence, all sorts of materials coming through from chatter, suggesting that exactly such a catastrophic attack might take place. He said that no one would have predicted Katrina, when the documentary account is of people over and over again around St. Louis, around New Orleans, saying that the levees were going to be under stress from even a moderate, much less a very fierce hurricane storm. I think the sort of central, you know, tragedy of administration will be seen to be that actually the world wasn't the right place in which to consummate the kind of optimistic minimum administration put in place by Ronald Reagan, that we could have a kind of low-tax, low-service world, and the economy would do its own thing. What the economy did when it was doing its own thing was to create massively greater income inequality than has ever been seen before in the United States. And whoever is the president come this coming Thursday will now have to manage a very ugly and painful situation in which those inequalities of income will be particularly bitter and potentially socially incendiary in a deep recession. So I actually don't think history is going to be a lot more charitable than I am currently being to this particular period of government.
Historian and broadcaster Simon Sharma. I'm Mike Durant. Still to come on today's Guardian Daily, we put the words success and Englishman in the same sentence. That's thanks to Lewis Hamilton.
It was only in the last lap that Hamilton actually secured the title, so much so that the Ferrari mechanics were cheering and celebrating in the pit lane, as it looked like Massa had done it, but down to the weather and the tyres really for Hamilton.
Before that, the men behind the near collapse of the banking system are being hauled in front of a select committee today to answer, how did we get into this mess? The Chancellor, Alistair Darling, the Governor of the Bank of England, Mervyn King, and the Chairman of the Financial Services Authority, Lord Turner, will be made to answer the big questions, many sent in by the public. John McFall is the committee's chairman and joins us on the line now. Apart from apportioning blame, what is the purpose of this inquiry?
What we've seen is the £37 billion bailout to the banks and the further standing behind the banks and other financial institutions in the country for £500 billion is the biggest intervention and bailout that the UK government has ever undertaken. It is therefore important that they are accountable for it, and that is why the Governor, the Chancellor and the Chairman of the FSA have been invited together to the committee. It's also very important that the public get an understanding of this issue, and we have a dedicated website and we've asked the public to send in questions, and to date I believe we have around 5,000 questions which the public have sent in. So this illustrates the interest and also the concern that the public has. And one of the lessons that I took when I visited Japan and looked at the banking crisis there, where the government procrastinated in terms of injecting money into it, and where they find they still have problems 14 or 15 years later, it is important that the public are on the side of those taking this action, namely the government, the bank and the FSA.
Does the committee have teeth? If you decide that all three parties were remiss, shall we say, what are you going to do?
Well, if you look back to Northern Rock, the Treasury Committee was the first on the block on that issue, and we had all the principles along. We found out exactly what went wrong and we pointed the way forward for the government. And there is now a banking regulation bill going through Parliament, largely shaped by the hearings which the Treasury Select Committee had. And that's why the Governor of the Bank of England has referred to the work that the Treasury Committee has done as invaluable in this process.
Now, you, as you mentioned, you've asked the public to submit questions, and I'm sure they haven't been holding back. What responses have you had?
Well, I've had a tremendous response from the public on a wide number of areas on the issue of where is this money? Where are we getting it? You know, why did the government nationalise the banks? Why were the FSA lax in supervision? What's the regulatory future going to be like in future? What about executive bonuses and the payments for board of directors and the housing market and the Icelandic banks? These are the range of issues which have come in to the committee.
And do you still need more questions? How do we get those to you?
Well, it's www.bankingcrisis@parliament.uk if anyone wishes to put questions in.
Finally, following humiliation in the cricket and the rugby this weekend, England needed some good news on the sporting front. And thanks to Lewis Hamilton, we got it. Now in the record books as the youngest driver to win the Formula One World Championship. In a thrilling finish, Hamilton managed to regain fifth place in the last few corners of the race to claim that top prize. Heartbreak for Felipe Massa, who thought he'd taken the title in front of a partisan crowd gunning for the Brazilian. Gemma Briggs followed the race for Guardian.co.uk.
Yeah, it couldn't really have been more thrilling, especially for the British fans. It was only in the last lap that Hamilton actually secured the title, so much so that the Ferrari mechanics were cheering and celebrating in the pit lane, as it looked like Massa had done it, but down to the weather and the tyres really for Hamilton.
Well, he was in the fifth place, which he needed to be in, up until the last four or five laps, and then he slipped behind, didn't he?
Yeah, it was the rain came late and a call was made to come in and take on intermediate tyres, which was going to be crucial. Everybody did, apart from Timo Glock from Toyota, who stayed out ahead, and that looked like it had scuppered Hamilton's chances as it left him lying in sixth place. And it was only on the final lap that Glock dropped back and Hamilton was able to cross the line fifth.
Well, you say Glock dropped back. Was that a deliberate move?
It's too early to tell. I mean, drivers notoriously try and steer clear of having, you know, allegiances and putting their cap with other drivers, because you never know what's going to happen in the future. But at the end of the day, it was starting to rain and spot with rain, and Glock was on the dry tyres, so it could well be that it was just the conditions.
Well, a risky PR move for Glock, because he was in front of a crowd which wanted Massa to win, wasn't it?
Yeah, the crowd seemed really disappointed, and Anthony Hamilton interviewed immediately after the race. One of the first things he said was it was such a shame that the crowd had to boo Hamilton, and Massa himself looked absolutely gutted, wiping away the tears but taking a bow in front of his home crowd. The last Brazilian driver to win the World Championship was Ayrton Senna, so obviously it means a lot to the Brazilians.
Well, also to Lewis Hamilton, Ayrton Senna, he says he's got looking over his right shoulder, doesn't he?
Yeah, he's a long-time hero of Hamilton's. Probably, as you would say, Senna was of most of the drivers on the track at the moment. So, yeah, I think it will be quite an emotional thing for Hamilton to have sealed the title in Brazil, although obviously the Brazilian crowd didn't agree.
Being British, I have to mention the weather. It played its part in the race, didn't it?
Absolutely. I mean, that's maybe the luck that a British driver needs to have on his side. It did help him win the title, but at the same time, it almost cost him the title. So I think it's probably best to forget about the rain.
Now, you've had previous dealings with Lewis Hamilton in a former job, haven't you? How do you think he'll react to just scraping this?
Last year was a bitter, bitter disappointment, clearly, for him and the team, for the rest of the country as well, I think. And, you know, he had to go out there and do the job today, and he did it. You could see the relief. He, you know, the cameras immediately after the race, he couldn't even speak. It meant so much to him, and I think it's a case of silencing the critics and proving that when he's under pressure, he can go out and win a title.
That's it for today's Guardian Daily. Tomorrow's will be available for download from 7:30. Producing today, Roxanne Escobarlis and Tim Mabey. I'm Mike Duran. Thanks for listening.
Guardian Daily. News and reports from around the world.